my wife and I would always have these conversations of like, someone's going to do a live faculty mentorship online thing for motion graphics. Or we would say, somebody should do that, and say, well, eventually someone will, some qualified person will, someone who really knows what they're doing is going to do it. And long story short, enough years went by where we just never saw it pop up, and we said, we're going to put this together.
All right, guys, listen up. You know that we're talking about the future of education, so it's always a delight for me to be able to find other people who share the same mindset, one of which is Michael Jones. If the name sounds familiar to you, it's not what you think. It's not the rapper. It's not the hip-hop artist. It's Michael Jones. He's the founder of MoGraph Mentor. We're going to talk about his journey, the importance of mentorship, his unusual path to getting there, and the future of education.
My name is Michael Jones. I'm the founder of MoGraph Mentor. I live in Bend, Oregon with my wife and my daughter. I have a background in motion design. I did that for many years. I really learned a lot working kind of the studio circuit in Portland. So many great art directors, creative directors that invested in me, totally changed my life. And that really began to blossom into a passion for working with younger artists and putting together educational programs. And somewhere along the line, I learned that I was more probably analytical than I was even talented artistically. So started putting together MoGraph Mentor, started recruiting the best motion designers in the world, and putting together the program. And now we're in year four.
That's incredible. When you said you're a motion designer, did you work on the design side or the animation side?
So I did both.
You did.
In the studios, yeah. I was working in a lot of smaller shops, 5 to 10 people, where, okay, Lenovo is doing a couple of short things for an internal display. Everybody in the studio is going to mock up boards, and we're going to pitch, and then we're going to work the best one, and then whoever's boards we're going to execute, now we're all animating. So I was really fortunate to get to be in an environment where you get to do everything, and then I began to freelance and take on clients and build a roster. So then you're really jack of all trades. You're going to build a 60-second explainer video. You're going to do some VFX work. So I've had a lot of fun getting to do the art direction and creative direction and actually animating it and doing some pretty hardcore VFX work. So I've had a lot of fun getting to kind of do a lot of different things.
Do you find that to be the case when you're working with smaller shops, that you're wearing a lot of hats?
I think so. I think those shops are looking for value. They're looking for people who are creative and willing to be flexible and willing to work hard. And I have a lot of empathy for studio owners. It's a really hard business. You know this much better than I do. I've never run a shop like that. But yeah, they're looking for people that can be flexible. And I'm a people pleaser. So I just wanted to go in there and, you want me to design? I'll design. You want me to animate? I will animate.
Okay, so inevitably the question is then, did you study design in school? How did you know how to do what it is that you do?
Yeah, so self-taught. I was a philosophy major my first year of undergrad. Just drank a lot of beer and smoked a lot of weed, so that didn't go very well, like many philosophy majors. So I'm largely self-taught. I did some online courses, actually, which actually left a very big lasting impact on me. But generally speaking, it was self-initiated, watching tutorials. We live in this time where there's so much information. You're a part of that now. You're giving out tremendous information about design, about business, about all of it. And then, like I said, being in internships, being in studios, that's where you really, you know, you go 100 miles an hour, 70 hours a week, and you really start to learn a lot. So I would say that ultimately I learned by, you know, sitting next to these really talented people. And yes, reading design books, art history books, I do think you need that theory. So yeah, largely self-initiated on that stuff.
That's great. And I love to hear that. And I don't know if self-learners are for everybody in terms of that situation where you can pick up a book or sit next to somebody and start to absorb it or even know how to ask those kind of questions. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I want to help our audience kind of fill some of the gaps, because what seems to be a pretty natural progression for people like you and me, this is like a black box to them. How does a philosophy major wind up getting his first opportunity in the creative space? And skipping over like all the lessons you learned, but how did you get even your first opportunity?
Yeah, so my brother-in-law went to Ringling School of Art and Design to study character animation. And he's at Disney now, which is why I'm down here. We're putting together a course right now together. And he really opened my eyes to a world of media communications and animation and design. I didn't really know it was a job. I didn't know it was a legitimate thing to, you know, shoot videos for a living or do pictures or edit or do design. And he really opened my eyes to that, and I got really, really excited about it. And then I was all in and began just spending a lot of time online, learning, consuming, reading books, going to Barnes & Noble, spending a lot of time getting into it. So I give him a lot of credit of, like, I actually had to see it as an example, or else I'm not sure I would have been able to put it together of, like, I can go all in on this and go this direction.
How old were you at that point?
So I was probably about 20.
Oh, okay. So were you done with school already?
Yeah, I had flamed out on that freshman year, and I didn't go back.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you're drinking beer and smoking pot, and then it led you just dropping out. That's it.
Well, dropping out is one way to say it. Another way to say it is they asked me not to come back.
That's the line, like, you can't fire me. I quit.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so your grades took a hit. Your teachers were like, this guy is not... The school's not right for you.
Not academically prepared, not mature, no business being there.
Okay.
Yeah.
They might have done you a favor.
They may have. I'm glad they didn't let me back for a second year.
Okay, so you're out, and then your sister, now it's your brother and brother-in-law.
Yeah.
And so you see this. Can you describe the feeling you had once you discovered this thing that you didn't even know existed?
Yeah, I was very excited. I was definitely geeking out on it. He was letting me play with a rig in Maya. He was working at Blue Sky at the time in New York, and I went up that summer and was hanging out with them, and he had, it might have been like the squirrel model on his home computer, Scrat, that Ice Age squirrel.
I love that guy.
And he's just showing me, you know, grab the elbow and rotate it, and you're just, it's like a marionette, like a little puppet that you're playing with, and you're posing it. And so he just let me, like, totally destroy the thing and, like, punch in keyframes and not know what I'm doing. But I think that night that he let me do it, I might have stayed up till 2 or 3 in the morning, just, like, continuing to play with it and being like, this is very interesting. And something about the creativity of it, but also the technical, analytical side, I think, appealed to me. So after that, then it became a process of trying to find real opportunities to get real experience and get into real environments. And I got an internship in Miami, where I had a grandparent who was willing to let me come live on their couch for 6 months to do this unpaid internship. So that was my first opportunity to do some video, to see other motion designers, and to understand it in an economic context of, like, wow, people are paying money for this work. This is a real thing.
Did you have a demo reel or any kind of portfolio to get that internship?
I did not.
So how do you think you got that job?
I sent an email, and then they were willing to let me come in, and it was unpaid, and I don't think they had that many applicants to do it. I don't think that many people wanted it. Yeah. It wasn't a very, I'm not going to, you know, denigrate them or anything, but no, I'm grateful they gave me the opportunity and to have grandparents. So it's not like I did. It's like people supported me and I was given opportunities. So I'm super grateful.
I think you made the most of the opportunity, it sounds like.
What choice do we have? Yeah.
Right. What is MoGraph Mentor?
MoGraph Mentor is an online school for motion design that has a really holistic approach. We're trying to teach people the technical, artistic, and professional skills they need to thrive in a career in motion design.
And how do you do it? Like, is it... There's the word mentor in there, so I want to know about that.
So we break students into groups of 6, and they have one weekly live session, which usually runs about 3-ish hours. And then during the week, we do school-wide live events of critique and then some career development time. So you have about 3 live events per week, as well as a website now of quite a bit of information to consume as well. And then it's project-driven. So your live class is you presenting your style frames, presenting your animation, presenting your edit, getting feedback, having to defend your work, having to explain your work. Why did you make this choice? How does this contribute to the story? And we have a program that runs a full 9 months. If you were to do a full 9 months, you'd invest $6,000. And if you do everything we ask, and it's a bit of a gauntlet, we kick your butt and we think that's necessary. I grew up in a military family, so tough love. We believe in that. If you can run the gauntlet, we have a job placement program where we will go out and try to find you connections, try to find you work, get your portfolio. You have to have a portfolio and it has to look good, but to get it in front of the right people and advocate for you, and we're trying to do some even new exciting things there.
What made you think that, you know what, there's a gap in the market space and I want to start this other idea?
Yeah, so I had done online classes, like I said, to learn animation, and that left such a lasting impact on me, on how affordable it was, how impactful it was, and it always stuck in the back of my mind. And I was doing motion design for many years, really just kind of understanding the craft and improving and understanding the industry. And my wife and I would always have these conversations of like, someone's going to do a live faculty mentorship online thing for motion graphics. Or we would say, somebody should do that. And say, well, eventually someone will, some qualified person will, someone who really knows what they're doing is going to do it. And long story short, enough years went by where we just never saw it pop up. And we said, we're going to put this together. We're going to recruit great people. We can do that. We can put together a marketing site. I probably saved up $20,000 just taking like extra freelance gigs after my studio time, and just almost maniacal of like, I'm going to get every dollar I can to invest into this idea. And so it took about a year to put together the curriculum. I was able to go to a lot of other art and design schools and speak to students there and faculty who, I have to say, were very open with what the curriculum looks like, what the framework for an art and design curriculum should be. And then being able to recruit really good people, we put it together and launched it, and we've been learning along the way, but we're in year four now, and I feel like we're really hitting our stride, and we love the students that we're working with, and we've worked with students in about 70 countries, so it has such a diverse international flair. We're learning so much about the world from all these individuals, and I'm just grateful to be a part of it.
Man, I have so many questions because you're talking my language here, and it's like I'm trying to contain myself, right? So I can't tell how old you are. So how old were you when you started? Well, how old were you in year one?
So I guess I was 26 because I'm 30 now.
Okay, you're still a young guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so 26-year-old, you're launching your own education platform.
Yeah.
And what did you use the money for? Like when you say like I was saving money, and you sounded like a man on a mission.
Yeah.
Saving up every little bit. You're like Scrat, the character, right? You went out for every nut and you scrolled it away.
Yeah.
And you put it, and then you're building this thing. Is this a custom platform that you built?
No. There's no technology we built. There was $12,000, so $6,000 for a marketing site to tell people about the program and the curriculum, $6,000 for an internal private WordPress site to host content and curriculum. And then we spent about $8,000 of me traveling around the country to go to studios and do on-camera interviews with really, really great designers, artists, creative directors, to create a foundation for the curriculum to get some materials. And so that's where that $20,000 went.
That's being very resourceful. So you're traveling around with some kind of like DSLR
shooting? Yeah. Might have been the Nikon D90 back then. And that was like maybe a 5D and a single lav mic and like a cheap single. It doesn't look good. We've reshot everything at this point. So.
No, that's
great.
But
you do what you can with what you have, right?
You are alive at exactly the right time to be alive.
Yeah.
Being 26 years old, which is, I think, a great age to start a business because you're like, you've got some experience behind you, but you're not like so deep into your own life that now any little move is going to be a risky move.
Yeah, that's right? A good point. Yeah.
And then moving beyond that, from the DSLR revolution being available to you so you can go shoot out, even in your own words, like, not the greatest quality, but at least you could do it at a certain level.
Yeah.
And then using WordPress and all the kind of things that you're using.
Vimeo,
right now.
Yeah. A lot of other people's technology just creates a foundation to do incredible things. I totally agree.
Okay. So 4 years into the business now, how are you doing?
Well, I think we're doing quite well. Like I said, we've had students in 70 countries. We've had about 700 applicants to the core program. We've accepted about 250 students in that time. And we usually have a waiting list. We don't always have enough instructors. Our biggest challenge right now is staffing mentors at the quality of who we already have. So we're trying to be really sensitive to like trying to stay at a certain level. And like, I'm not really even good enough to mentor, I don't think. Like these individuals, I'm learning from them as they're teaching the students. I'm the administrator. I mean, I know my strengths, I know my role, and it's to put it together, keep the wheels turning, keep the trains running on time. So growth, I think, is going to come out of continuing to build relationships with really talented people who also have an inclination to invest in young people and students, because not everybody does.
I'm an instructor. Yeah. Or I used to be.
I think you're a very good one.
I play one on TV, something like that. And let's say I want to get involved in the program. You have your vetting process, but what's the commitment for each instructor?
Yeah, you commit for a 3-month semester We run 3 semesters a year, but a mentor commits for that 12 weeks, and you would have 1 live session a week. So let's say you said every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard, you're going to sit in front of this computer and spend 3 hours getting pitched and giving critique to 6 individuals.
Great. So I'm making a 3-hour commitment once a week for 12 weeks.
Correct.
And what do I get paid?
You get paid 30% of each student's tuition. So you'll make just under $4,000 for your time.
Okay.
Comes out to about $75 an hour.
Do you prepare the syllabus and the assignments, or the instructor runs
Correct.
It?
No, everything's prepared.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just have to show up.
Just show up and be awesome.
Well, I could do one of those two things. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Wow, that takes away a lot of the work.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly were not going to ask people to, hey, why don't you put together a syllabus and show up and do the thing? It's like, no, we're going to put together a handbook and a curriculum. And we went off of the NASAD standards. NASAD is the accrediting body, National Association of Schools of Art and Design. They put together very clear frameworks for their accredited institutions on what an art and design curriculum ought to be. They want you to teach technical skills. They want you to teach professional skills. They want you to teach the artistic theory, and they want you to contextualize it in history, in economics, in politics, and in culture. That's what they're asking for, and that's what we do.
Wow. Okay, that sounds already better than some schools that I know about.
Well, if you're accredited, you have to do those things. We're not accredited because we're an online school. They don't recognize us, but I still read their reports and their handbooks, and we are pretending to be a part of their
But
their
even
world.
Still, I know
because the standards are good. It's good standards.
Those are good standards and guidelines to follow. Just I'm not sure everybody's hitting it to the T, you know?
Yeah, perhaps not. I can't speak to every school.
I don't want to. I'm going to get myself in trouble. But okay. All right. So, and it's limited to 6 people?
Per group.
Per group.
Yeah.
So the
we started with 12 and it didn't go well.
Too many bodies.
Too
right?
many.
Yeah. It's almost like that private art school experience.
Yeah.
When I tell some people how many students I have had in my classes at Art Center, they freak out. Like, what? And I'm like, no, that's a lot of people.
How many? 25, 30?
8.
Oh, 8.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. So sometimes it's 4.
Oh, good.
And I spend an hour per person per crit.
Yeah.
And it's bananas, right? And to contrast that, I went to a community college, and it was a lecture hall.
Okay.
Hundreds of students.
Yeah.
The teacher was like 3 inches tall from my vantage point. And if you were sleeping, eating, didn't matter because he couldn't even see you.
Yeah.
That's how far away you were.
Yeah.
Stadium seating.
Yeah.
So when I went to an art school and we actually got to critique and look at the work, it was a very different experience. It's that one-to-one. So it feels like you've taken the best of traditional art school design education, taken away all the bad stuff, and just left all the good stuff.
That sentence is almost identically what is on our website.
Oh, okay. Look at that. Maybe I was poking on the website. Who knows? Subconsciously, it's like permeated my brain.
Yeah.
But really, we talk about this a lot, that teachers want to be able to teach on their own time, expecting them to develop the syllabus and do all that other stuff. And grading sucks, too.
Yeah.
And I suppose we got rid of all that stuff, right?
Or do you? We don't do grades.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. It's like you either show up or not. It's your own money. It's your responsibility. Yeah. You get what you put in.
Yeah.
I love that. So small classroom sizes, the best teachers, and you make it easier for them because, to be honest, I mean, being on the west side, even driving to a school like Otis, which is not that far away in miles, it takes at least an hour for me to get there.
Yeah.
An hour there, an hour back. I've already given up 2 hours that I can't get back.
Yeah.
This is the best part. And they can do it from their home, from their studio, wherever they want to do it from, right?
Yeah. The flexibility gives us a huge advantage in recruiting faculty. And I have a lot of empathy for the physical residential campus schools because, like you said, you have to live in a pretty close proximity to make that a reality. So it's far more expensive for those schools to get instructors than us to say, oh, yeah, do it on your own time. You pick your class time, go into your guest bedroom sort of thing. So yeah, that is an advantage, I think.
Okay. How has the placement been for the students that are qualified to be placed?
It's gone better than I thought it would because it's a pretty tall order to promise people we're pretty specific, job placement services.
Yeah.
What we can do is get you to have the conversations, get the conversation started, get your portfolio in front of the right people. But, we've had students go work at Google and Giant Ant and a lot of different really, really good companies. And I don't tend to want to take a lot of credit for that. We don't advertise that because, you know, you spend 9 months with us. The kids that are going to go get the best jobs came in with some good experience. And they came in because they were self-taught and they want some theory and they want to they want the challenge of a really senior level designer and animator to push back against them to grow themselves. So they deserve a lot of the credit, but Yeah, I mean, we'll send emails and put their work in front of the right people.
And beyond the teacher-student relationship, you said they also have to present to the entire school.
Well, right? Not necessarily. I will pull up their work. So every Thursday, we'll do sort of a school-wide critique. Well, I'll give some love to some of the better work that we see. And that's just a good moment for us to see what other people are working on and get some encouragement and get some of that peer conversation going.
Okay. And then what do you guys do with that work? You pull it out and everybody has an opportunity to talk about it?
Yeah, so I do a live stream, and then I'm on one side kind of critiquing it, and everybody just gets to see it. And then the students are there, and they can kind of type in and give their feedback as well.
I see.
Yeah.
Do you create any other kind of communities for students talk to peer-to-peer?
So we use Slack internally. Okay. So, and because we are international, it's going pretty much 24/7, because when it's night here, it's morning somewhere else. So yeah, it feels just like we've all been having this massive, slightly organized conversation now going on a couple of years.
Michael and Chris talked a little about numbers. You can look up some of that on his blog. He's been pretty transparent about it. They also talked about the early success of MoGraph Mentor and what the financial future looks like for the company.
You know, I probably need to do better about that, at putting some financial goals in place. I'm so in the weeds constantly of just running it and doing support, that the goal is to do a really good job every year and take in as many students as we can responsibly do with enough really good faculty. The good faculty part is difficult to solve, actually, because there's a lot of talented people. But being a committed mentor in this kind of holistic approach of, like, we want you to talk about everything and be so open and talk about career and this and that, it takes a certain personality. So we've had certain individuals emerge of, like, this person's a teacher, this person really gets it. And we've had other people that are really, really talented, and maybe it just wasn't for them.
Striking that balance is especially hard these days. What are people willing to pay for? What do you need to give away? How valuable is your experience to the consumer?
So you've got to bring value. It's got to be really, really good. It's got to be that Seth Godin irresistible offer. It has to be so much value that it's like, well, I'd be crazy not to spend $100 on this. So just trying to stay humble. I'm not trying to be greedy. I'm just trying to create really, really good products, do it as quickly as I can. I do think pace matters and urgency matters. But keeping an eye towards, don't get ahead of myself, continue to do a good job. Remind myself there's a lot of smart people now offering value. I feel like I constantly need to check myself as things move quickly. Even somebody like you, I see you put out how to bid a project on YouTube and it's free. And it's like, I had something in the pipeline that was trying to sell some career development advice. And instantly in that moment, you have to check yourself and say, is it really valuable? You've got to be honest with yourself. This guy just solved the problem. It's like, nobody needs to pay $100 to hear me talk about it.
But
he's literally telling you what to do. There's nothing more.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watching on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Here's my theory, and feel free to debate or disagree or agree, okay? My theory is this. You give people value, they're going to come and find a way to give you money back.
Yeah.
Like value begets value. So you can create almost the exact same thing and people feel like, you know what, they're connected to your tribe and your mission.
Yeah.
I feel like there's just really earnest and you're doing it for all the right reasons. Your motivation is in the right place and that you're creating this school that you wish you knew about and had access to that just didn't exist.
Yeah.
And you're doing it for a very affordable price and you're not looking to make a quick buck and exit.
Yeah.
You're in it for the long haul, as far as I can tell. So yeah. I know that
there's nobody to sell this to. this is my, yeah. Nobody wants this.
Well, there are other online schools that teach very similar things.
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
I honestly think there's like, you know, within the marketing space, like 5 or 6 original business philosophy concepts, and it's just being regurgitated over and over by different people through their personalities, and you just belong to that tribe. Gary Vaynerchuk is not inventing this stuff.
Yeah.
Like Jim Rohn might have invented it, but you know, now there's a couple, there's 1,000 gurus and marketing experts to help you sell and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it's really kind of giving it in the package that people want.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. I agree. You shouldn't just say, oh, well, that exists, so I won't do it. I more mean check myself on should I be doing it a certain way? Because like think about Gary Vaynerchuk. He gives so much. I mean, it's basically motivation. Like actually more like you. You're giving really specific like budget. Here's how to do a line item. Here's how to do a bid. That's really valuable information. So then that kind of inspires me to say, well, maybe all my pre-recorded stuff in that vein should be free, and then you should pay for it. Then now we'll do some live accountability groups or something. Let's go to the next level in. And I actually like that. I like that we, you know, we don't even really know each other, but at the same time, you're shaping my business by what you're doing. And I actually think that really benefits people who then are consuming it. But to your point about tribes and being connected, I think that's, yeah, pretty accurate.
Heyo, John Roth here from the future. I'm here to tell you guys about the Pro Membership. A lot of you have been asking about how you can engage with us and where you can go to meet like-minded individuals. Well, I'm here to tell you how. For $75 a month with the Pro Membership, you can join Chris Doe's collective of creative entrepreneurs, which includes everyone from designers to strategists to writers and more from all over the world. Also included is over 40 hours of exclusive videos on a variety of topics, from the business of design to project management, and access to 2 pro calls a month where you can have your questions answered by Chris live. All that and more in your Pro Membership for just $75 a month. Not afraid of commitment? Sign up for a year and save $150. The Pro Membership, exclusively in the online store. Go to thefuture.com/shop for more.
I guess, and you touched on this, I know I'm switching gears slightly here because you had mentioned this, but creating a scalable business is kind of important for the long run.
Yeah.
Because your instructors get tired, they get burned out, and God forbid something happens to them, you're not only the quality of instruction is gone, but what do you do with that? And I like this idea also of creating a business model that profits the instructor and the school.
Yeah.
I understand that there needs to be some kind of balance there where they can make money while they sleep. And that was one of my big challenges. Okay, so maybe this is a perfect segue into what's wrong with traditional art and design education today.
Yeah.
And I know we both have very strong opinions about this.
Okay.
Okay, so let's tag team here. This is going to get a little crazy, I think, maybe. Who knows?
Well, the problem is it's too expensive.
Okay.
The question is, why is it too expensive? And it's kind of a long answer, but the cost of higher education was actually going down from the beginning of the 1960s towards the end of the 1970s. And then around 1978, you see the cost curve start to go up and is still going up to this day and has never gone down. We created the Federal Department of Education in 1978 as a cabinet level position of the executive branch. This is not an anti-government rant, but it's just a statement of fact that in that year, we created new funding mechanisms and basically wrote a blank check and created private loan guarantees. We told private banks, give students loans for college. Don't vet them. Don't ask them if it's a good investment. Give them the money because we will pay it if they cannot. That removed the discipline, whether or not it's a good investment. Hey, I have $65,000 a year to go to higher ed. We really could care less. We're getting our money back. College costs more now because it can. That's a slight indictment of the big schools. I don't think it's a conspiracy or anybody wants it to be expensive. There's so many good people in education. I've been hearing many panels and read many books. The presidents of these universities, they do care. I won't speak for everybody, but many who have heard, they want it to be affordable. They want it to be good. But this has been a 2-4% every year tick up, 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 because there's no downward pressure pulling that price back down because we have a third party payer. You show up on campus, sign a couple things. Oh, I'll have to worry about this $40,000 later. I'm 18 years old. I don't even fully understand the investment I'm making. So the problem is here we are now, 40 some years later, it's too expensive. We know this as a almost documented fact that if you are not in the top 10 to 15% of your peers at a four-year art school, 120-credit-hour program, it is not worth it. It's a bad investment. If you are not a top 10-15% performer, go find yourself a 60-credit-hour two-year program. There is more value for you. The top 25% of two-year students economically outperform the bottom 75% of four-year students in art schools.
Where are you getting this data from?
Mostly the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I can send you some of this stuff over.
No, I like it. You sound really smart right now.
Okay. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So I just do things on gut. Like, it's too expensive. Don't do this. And you're actually, you've researched
I've been obsessing over this stuff.
Yes, it sounds like you have.
Yeah, more recently. Just to try to understand it, because I wanted to go to art school so much. But there are... Okay, so what's the solution? Well, so a place like Ringling School of Art and Design, who I have very high regard for, it's an excellent place. Again, if you're in that top group, it's the best decision you ever made. My brother-in-law went there, he did character animation, now he's at Disney, making $200K a year, best decision he ever made. He paid money for it, but he then...
He'll get his money back.
He'll get his money back. He's going to make millions of dollars over the course of his career. Okay, good for him. That's not the case for everybody. Another big problem we have, the 30% problem. 30% of all students entering university will not make it past freshman year. Okay, here's one. That's a documented fact. About 2.1 million kids a year come out of our high schools. That's nationally across the country. So you're talking 700,000 kids a year will take out a loan, do 1 year of school, and then walk away. That is, over a course of several decades now, billions of dollars in unperforming debt. They don't have really any much value back from that. They don't have any credentialed piece of paper that they can go and make a career off of necessarily. That is a problem of standards that have begun to slip. The schools, I'm not saying greedy, but there's a guy named Charles Murray who's written a lot of books. One was called Coming Apart, where in part of it, he's talking about a slight complacency that a lot of university presidents will attest to in it became a big business. And there's not a lot of incentive for them to make reforms that would mean they would get less money each year. Now, the unfortunate part of that is a lot of it is in the form of debt, both public and private. So now we have a lot of people taking out a lot of money. So I would love to see radical reforms in testing out ways to bring the cost per credit hour down. So let's go back to the NASAD standards. They demand an art school give you 65% of your four-year degree in your core competencies. You want to go learn to be an illustrator? 65% of your classes must be directly related to your skill. The other 35% is that liberal arts umbrella. They want you to take English, math, psych, Chinese studies, anything. They want to expose you. Again, I like the premise. That's good. We want to contextualize your skills for the rest of your life. I think that makes you better and smarter. However, it is becoming untenable to ask students to pay $1,000 credit hour for the Chinese studies class, as good as it is, when we have more affordable alternatives. Could it be an online class? Could it be a self-led thing where then they take a test? Now, Bill Gates has gone around the country talking about this, pushing on embrace a hybrid model, start bringing the cost per credit hour down on some of those ancillary things. There's some people who want to blow up the BA and say the BA is dead. The BA is a bad idea. It was a good idea in the 1960s. It's not a good idea anymore. It's not going anywhere. All the federal money is tied to it being in a liberal arts degree. That means reform. That means we have to ask these institutions, find ways to bring the cost down. But again, what's their incentive to do that? I don't see it. So students need to be very wise. They need to understand the gravity of their investment. They need to make absolutely sure they're not in that 30% window where they're going to flame out. And that's a question of maturity and also agency. Like, how much did you decide you needed to be at art school, and how much was it you thought you should do? You didn't know what you wanted to do. The guidance counselor said something. Maybe the parents pushed you in. Really make sure you belong on campus if you're going to go to those top tier schools and pay those really, really, really high prices that after the early 2000s, you can't even walk away from in a bankruptcy type of resolution. That's with you forever now. And we actually did see a big cost bump after that law was passed in the early 2000s. Again, that's really unfortunate that as soon as the opportunity is there, there's even less pressure and they can just keep ticking those prices up. So there's been general cost inflation. Everything's more expensive. But if you look at real estate costs, healthcare costs, education really stands alone as a really big problem in terms of how quickly it's become more expensive.
So what are the other things that we want to tackle in terms of like the problems you're trying to solve with an online school versus a traditional brick and mortar school?
Yeah, I would love to be associated with helping solve some of these problems. I would love to be associated with a brick and mortar school. I actually think there is huge value in removing people from their environment for a residential campus experience. That's great. That's a privilege. However, if it's like a resort life for 4 years, then that's a problem. You don't need to be spending that much money. So I actually, for some reason over the last year, began mocking up like in C4D, actually in 3D, campus models with like tiny houses and specking that out. And I kept asking myself, could I build a residential campus for $1 million? Could I do it? The answer is no, you can't. But you probably could for under $2 million. So I actually think we're going to see some really exciting things. I think there's going to be, I hope I get to be a part of it in one way or another, but I think we might see some really, really innovative stuff come because there is so much pressure now on these big art schools. I feel like it's becoming untenable to continue to ask these prices when the secret's kind of out of like, especially in what we do, the degree in some contexts is important, but mostly doesn't mean that much. It's a show and tell business. I would never hire someone who told me they had a great degree. And then I said, well, yeah, let me check out your portfolio and it looks bad. Okay, next, that's over. That conversation's over. So I think we're gonna see some innovative stuff and I hope I get to be a part of it.
Now that I understand your platform and your business and what you're doing, I feel like you're like the people's champion.
The people's
principal, something like that. You know, you've created a school for the people and you're trying to make it as easy for them to understand as a business model and to mirror the brick and mortar system, almost to the degree in which you're thinking about there's a brick and mortar component to what it is that you're ultimately gonna do.
Right. Yeah, I hope so. I hope I get to do it. I've had some meetings with investors recently even where I pitched them on saying, let's build a campus in Central Oregon. I want 16 double dorms built out of earth-poured little huts. And I want to build a main facility that's a broadcast campus in which you'll have thousands of online students and a really, really serious core broken down of about 30 students. And they didn't like it. They're not going to give me any money for that. But I had a hell of a lot of fun just pitching people.
I like it. You got a dream.
Just pitching people on
it.
I'm ready to talk about it. I'm ready to get out there. I'm ready to keep going. And there's so many smart, brilliant, wealthy people who are like already going down this path. Bill Gates is super into this. And I would, you know, YouTube his talks on education if you're interested in the subject. But if there's a chance for me to do something residential, I might take some risk.
So let's do this.
Okay.
Our podcast audience is tiny. It's a drop in the bucket, right? Okay. It's a drop in the ocean. But why don't you appeal to that person, that philanthropist right now, that billionaire who shares your dream and just didn't hear it? Why don't you just pitch it to us right now in case, and this is a very slim chance that it actually might reach their ears, that they can say like, you know what? I like Michael. I like what he stands for. I'm going to give that guy $2 million. It's a small investment.
Well, I would say it makes sense because it actually would be quite profitable. I think that this hybrid model of education in which you have a small core of very committed, very highly vetted students in a physical space acts as a foundation for a broadcast campus in which you can have tens of thousands of people deriving the value from that moment. Now, if you can build that in a really affordable way and pay attention to every line item and have an ethos of every penny counts, not only will you create a really, really powerful educational model, you would actually set an example that I think other people would then say, oh, we're gonna do this too. So I love anything that builds as a model that other people can work off of. That's a pretty weak pitch, but there it is. That's just me describing it.
That's your operating system, right? That you think that if you perfect it, Google does this all the time. Once they perfect their playbook, they open source their code, if you will.
Why not? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I know they have a school program too that's built on the Google system.
I know. I'm always waiting for companies like that to just like totally turn the thing on its head.
They're doing it.
Yeah.
Do you know about it?
I don't.
I don't know what it's called. I want to say it's called like 42 weeks. I can't remember. It's like something like this where, and I talked to the, I'm spacing on his name, but he was the chief creative officer for Google Creative Labs.
Okay.
Okay, and he was talking about their education model and how they innovate. They look at everything as Google doesn't enter into the market unless it can do, I think, 10x.
Oh, wow.
It wants to radically change everything by a factor of 10x. And so he had told me, like, okay, you look at the pyramid, and you guys are listening, this is going to be, I'm going to do my best to kind of help you visualize this. He says that the bottom of the pyramid are accountants, cost consultants, project planners, and kind of administrative people. They do a lot of research and kind of think about what it is that the market needs. And then they get into project management, project leaders, and that kind of stuff. And you keep going down that path. And all the way at the very top are designers. I'm talking about industrial designers, interface designers, graphic designers, packaging people. And they touch it last. He says, so you've gone through this very slow process that is just kind of built on the bottom line. He says, what we want to do at Google is invert the pyramid and crush the other layers out. So we start with the designers. Let's start with an idea and have the designers make mock-ups. They're all about building high, you know, like it almost looks like high fidelity mock-ups.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So it's like, can we get the teams internally to be excited about the concept just as a proof? Nothing works. It's all fake.
Yeah.
They're all animations,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's why they hire so many designers. And he says, if we can get the teams excited, now let's ask the engineers, can this be built? And then they bring it, so it's inverting the whole thing.
Yeah.
So they're trying to teach that as an open source thing, and they partnered up with a school in New York. I forget what it's called. School of Visual Arts, I think, SVA.
Okay.
And they're beta testing this. And this was a year and a half ago. So I think they're out of beta now.
Okay.
And I've seen bits of it online.
Oh, interesting.
So they're looking for very specific kind of students. Yeah. The cost of the tuition is super low.
Okay.
Okay, it's tiny. And you're done with it in a very specific amount of time. Mm. But they're very selective about who they bring in.
Yeah.
And they're trying to recreate the same kind of a dynamic team that Google has in terms of the right mix of people and personalities and skill sets.
Yeah.
So I think this is almost like a postgraduate thing and not an undergrad thing.
Yeah.
Because you have to come in with skills.
Yeah.
But very interesting.
No, that sounds fantastic. No, I'm convinced this is all going to get sorted out, and really, you know, top companies are going to figure this stuff out, and entrepreneurs and innovators. And so I'm pretty optimistic that there's going to be a lot of new options coming.
And in terms of your point of view on schools adopting to this, I think that's where your optimism, I don't share it totally.
Okay.
Because we always talk about this, where Guy Kawasaki has a great term. He's like, if you want to innovate, you have to jump the curve. And you can't make incremental changes to your system and innovate. And he's and the saying goes something like, the people who invented the dot matrix printer should have invented the laser printer, but they didn't.
Yeah.
And the laser printer people should have invented the inkjet or whatever. However it goes, it just keeps going.
Blockbuster, and they never should have created Netflix, but they didn't.
They didn't. They never do.
Yeah.
And it's because it's hard to ignore the money that's coming in. It keeps pouring in until it doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's not a slow fade. It's a quick fall off.
Yeah.
Right? So here's where you and I start to differ a little bit. I'm not the people's champion. I'm not by any stretch of the imagination. I think I'm more of a maverick, a revolutionary, a dissenter, and I want to just change the entire system. Like, just clear the board. Let's re-engineer the system from the ground up. And so adding on top of the issue of price, or it's too expensive, is all the other things that I kind of have a bone to pick, right? So here we go. I think the price serves as a very strong filter, and it limits access. So who are we seeing going to private art schools now? People of means mostly, and a couple of people who are supported by the system through generous grants or scholarships. But those are very few and far between.
Sure.
It's built on the backs of people who have means, wealthy parents, and so they're international now. Because we're running out of regular old Americans who can afford to go to a school that tuition is, I don't know, $20,000, $21,000 a semester.
Yeah.
And so I've done the math before. You're going to graduate with several hundred thousand dollars of debt that you may never be able to pay back. And now, backed with your numbers, we know then that 60% of them are going to have a hard time paying that back.
Yeah.
If we're being, you know, true to those numbers, right?
Yeah.
So there's that part. There's the other part of geography, that to go to a private art school, you have to be able to live and be close to where the school is.
Yep.
And so that cuts off a whole part of the whole population. And so, again, it's about access. It's like, there's, I don't want to get overly political about this, but there's a lot of talk about Trump and the wall. The wall's already been built. It's just through a socioeconomic wall. It's been there. It's kind of invisible, but it exists.
Sure.
And the other part that's a little bit different between what you're building and what I think we're trying to build here is time. Meaning that I think the school of the future starts when you wake up. When you're ready to start, you start. So I'm all about like time displacement. this temporal thing. So if we can create courses or materials that self-study, you go at your own pace. If you want to redo the first week material for like five times in a row, you do that.
Yeah.
And you do it at your own pace when you have free time, because we want you to be alert and ready. So it goes on your schedule. Okay. The other thing is about, I forgot now. So we talk about expense, geography, time. So those, I know what it is. About the two most important things that matter to the success of a school, teachers and students. Mm. Students want access to the best teachers, and teachers want access to great students, but they also want to work when they want to work, which you've done. Mm. You made it convenient for them. And I think the other part to it is, like, I want to profit as a teacher from the work that I create.
Yeah.
When I'm sleeping.
Yeah.
So I want a form of passive income. I want great students. I want passive income. And I want to help build an audience for the people that love what it is that I do.
Yeah.
And I think if we can solve those things, we've got a really great platform. And, you know, I'm actually looking at what Linda did with selling herself to LinkedIn for something like $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
She was my teacher in school.
That's a good day. Yeah.
It's a really good, I mean, if you think about that, and I often think about this, I went to Art Center and I sit in faculty meetings and I think, gosh, I wonder if Art Center were for sale, what would the price tag be?
Mm.
I don't think it would be $1.5 billion.
Mm-mm.
Michael and Chris went on to discuss the geography of need, how customers from all over the world are tuning in to the Future and MoGraph Mentor for information and fundamentals, and how this affects the balance of education. So why are things like the Future and MoGraph Mentor taking off in popularity?
And I'm actually surprised more of those schools don't do it. It's like Art Center, why don't they have 3 Black Magics in every single room and live broadcast every single class to tens of thousands of people across the world? It's like they've already created the value of bringing smart instructors in, bringing students together. It's like the companies that are most positioned to do the next thing, for some reason, tend not to do it.
Well, I think I can't guess as to why Art Center, Otis, or CalArts might not want to do that. I have no idea. But, like, I think if it works, they just keep going. Yeah. It takes a lot of work to set up these programs.
Yeah.
Who's going to drive this? Who's knowledgeable?
Yep.
And you and I have talked about this. I think when you talk about teachers, there are great practitioners of what it is that they do. They're great craftspeople. They're experts. And then there are great teachers. There are very few people who are great teachers and great practitioners of what it is that they do.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to add one layer of complexity. Very few of those people are good on camera.
Mm.
That are dynamic and engaging.
True.
Because
you're
stripping out a lot of that chemistry, that energy. When two people sit in a room like you and I are right now versus us doing a Skype call.
Yeah.
Although I'm looking at your face, it's not the same.
Yeah.
Because there's like these little micro expressions, you're shifting your body language that I can read.
Yeah.
I'm programmed to read that as a human being.
Yeah.
That we miss. So having those really dynamic people who can communicate clearly, who can design a very good course.
Yeah.
That's not so easy.
It's not easy.
So now we're talking about a very small fraction of people.
Yeah.
And I talked to Joey. Do you know Joey Kornman?
Sure.
I talked to him. He's like, you know, he was casting people. He tried people and it didn't work.
Mm.
So then he learned a lot about how to cast the right kind of teacher.
Oh, yeah. He's
basically building another person like him with a different discipline.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to do.
Yeah.
And lastly, I think it's about not cannibalizing your own market.
Mm.
So the theory goes, if we broadcast it for free or for lower, why would anybody continue to go to the school? And they might have a valid argument there. But I don't know if you know this or not, but Kodak invented the digital sensor that's used in all of these digital cameras.
Okay, did not know that.
They invented it, and the higher-ups said, we're not going to do that. That'll kill film.
Yeah.
So they let it go.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And is it the Xerox Palo Alto Labs invented so many things as part of this genius group. They invented PostScript, Ethernet, a whole bunch of these things. They're like, nobody wants this stuff. So they all left and started their own companies.
Jeez.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
The company who invented Ethernet and the graphic user interface, they didn't see a market for it, which is incredible, because I guess the forces be, and if you listen to a lot of these people who study like what's wrong with corporations, it's all about making quarterly reports and earnings report.
Yeah.
That's all it's about.
Short-term thinking.
Short-term.
Yeah.
It's never about the long-term. So in short-term, they're incentivized to think this way.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the smarter people who are more researched about this. I'm not going to go on about that, but those are the reasons I think people don't want to change.
Yeah. No, I don't know enough about these large institutions to understand why they can't do things that in hindsight seem so obvious and so simple. And clearly they have all the resources. Like, you think about a Blockbuster. Clearly you had to see, like, DVD, they're mailing people DVDs. Like, the second that happened, you had to know, like, this is a revolution. And then digital streaming, it's like, they have access to the most exclusive, like, market research in the world, and yet there is something that keeps you from taking that risk. And perhaps when a bureaucracy simply gets too large, it's just too big a ship to steer in another direction, but leaves more opportunity for the rest of us, I guess.
Yeah, I think very few large organizations have the leadership with that kind of vision, that boldness, because it's better just to go along that path.
Yeah,
you rock the boat, you change things, it doesn't work out. Guess what your future prospects look like?
Yeah.
You're not the turnaround expert. You're the person who ruined such a wonderful institution.
Yeah. Risk aversion.
Yeah. And I don't know the gentleman's name, but the guy who's now running Microsoft is doing some wonderful things. Mm. And it took an outsider, or not an outsider, but a person with fresh thinking to then change it. Now we're looking at Microsoft products like, they're kind of sexy now.
Yeah.
Like, what happened to my Apple?
Yeah.
Right? But it took a change in thinking and not just doing more of the same.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's these smaller firms seem to just innovate so quickly, maybe because it's more life and death for those who don't have the cushion of an existing profit. And I'm just excited about all the things I think we're going to see. And I think the big art schools are really well positioned to lead. But if they don't, I think you're going to see lots of new stuff. Like, even Creative Live in Seattle is already doing that. Like, they basically have a little campus where you can, I'm pretty sure you can still watch any Creative Live class free, which is interesting. Because then as soon as the broadcast is over, then it's like $99 or something. And now intuitively you think, why are you allowing people to watch if you're giving it all away? No, people don't have time to sit at their computer all day and try to track this stuff down. Like, there is value that you've captured and they can do it on their own time. And now it's basically a digital textbook that they'll pay $100 for, and that gives them value. I think the next big thing is, like, okay, do your classes that are super scalable, and that's where most of the money is going to be. But live faculty time is that thing that we do that not that many people do, that I think, like, you're giving that when you do a live thing.
That's unique to you guys.
But you do it a little bit.
We do, but we're not, that's not our business model.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not as much money. It's probably
that's
why.
That's just marketing for us. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. If I'm being honest. But what you do is you pair up six students with a live instructor to give real feedback.
Yeah.
That's very valuable. And that go person's deep. Time is valuable.
And go deep. Yeah. And
we have no plans on doing anything like that. So that's unique to you guys.
Yeah.
Joey has a different version of that, but he's doing something on a bigger scale, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I want you to paint a very bold kind of roadmap as to where MoGraph Mentor is going to be in 2 to 3 years. What's your rollout like going to be? Like, what kind of things do you want to add? You mentioned a physical campus. Okay, let's say that's one of them. 2 to 3 years, that might be a little tight, but let's just be very bold.
Okay.
Okay? Paint the boldest stroke, if you want, the boldest picture of what this is going to look like in a couple of years. And you could say anything you want.
Yeah. In a perfect world, I'd love to have a residential campus that acts more like a broadcast and reality TV studio. I actually have this inclination to believe that if I could get 15 to 30 really hardcore students onto a campus with really world-class instructors, that not only would you live broadcast in a really robust way, I'm talking 6 or 7 cameras, I would also have every single student in their dorm their own little live broadcast set up to video journal every day to allow online students to use them as a conduit and of experience and self-actualization. So I see this weird thing of reality TV and education kind of merging to provide value in these sort of concentric circles where, okay, if you're on campus, it's the most expensive, and then you have an interactive, engaged experience, and then you're going to catch the pre-record later, and things get cheaper as you go out. Perfect world, we would have a really nice little broadcast campus in that model to continue to focus on the technical, artistic, and professional aspects of working as a motion designer.
That's awesome. Any products?
More digital products, more classes, more e-courses that I really think of as like digital textbooks. So we're doing this mastering character design. We're going to do a mastering art direction with Lucas Brooking, who's at Buck in Sydney. We're going to try to, I'm trying to recruit Sarah Beth Hulver, who's in Portland, who's a really good art director. I want to do some stuff with her. and then sort of a mastering keyframe animation with Handel, Eugene, who's here in Los Angeles. He was at Royale for a number of years and is now freelancing. So we'll continue to put those together. That's my 2017, is just to 100 miles an hour getting that stuff put together.
Great. Have you considered doing like an artist in residence kind of program, like a virtual one where maybe you can have guest crits and pay a person, just like if I'm interested, but I don't commit to 12 weeks.
Sure.
To have a program where you can sign up for this bonus thing where you have a rotating group of people who jump in the course at any one given time and give you their 3 hours and then they're out.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Maybe think about
that. That's a really
like
good
that,
idea.
Because that would be appealing to somebody like me. And there are a lot of people out there that I think aren't ready, don't see themselves as a teacher per se, and you don't want to make that commitment anyways. It's a good way to see what value they bring.
Yeah, we do a lot of guest speakers, but that actually is quite a good idea. One other thing we're putting together that actually was born out of a corporate request was we're going to put together a little 8-week live faculty course called Director's Academy, where we actually had a corporation reach out to us and say, we have a lot of internal marketing art directors and creative directors. We want them to get better at storytelling. And they saw a couple of our mentors and we said, these people are world-class directors. We will pay you almost any sum of money to get our people in front of this person. So we're going to put together kind of a fourth level, more advanced class now. We've been doing those core three classes. So that'll be a little bit of a fun thing for us to do.
Great. Okay, so here's the crazy question. What's in your blind spot? What is it that you aren't aware of right now that may be the thing that kind of knocks you off?
Yeah.
And that's a weird question to ask, because obviously...
No, I think it's a good question. I think, like I said, I'm always trying to see what other people are doing to check on that, to kind of check myself of, I don't want to get complacent and assume that the stuff I did 3 years ago is even right for the moment now. Now, I still feel the live faculty time is still working really, really well. And I go pretty exclusively off the student feedback. They paid the $2,000. How do you feel about it? You just paid $2,000 for 3 months. Are you coming back for another one? How did you feel about what just happened? I'd say 98% of feedback has been like, this is incredible. This is life-changing. I can't believe this person invested so much time in me. I learned so much. I didn't realize I would learn so many different things. I learned from my peers. I learned from my instructor. So I may have a bit of a blind spot in terms of the value of pre-recorded content. It's hard to get a sense of like how quickly the bottom is falling out on that, if it is.
So is it $2,000 for a 3-month course? Is that the price?
And then we have three classes. So that's the $6,000 if you do all three for the full 9 months.
Okay, so it's like, but
2,000 and then 2,000 and then 2,000.
Every 3 months.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's three courses basically.
Yeah.
Okay, three instructors.
Oh yeah, different instructor. Yeah, each time.
Okay. So you're talking about $2,000. Okay, that's interesting. All right. So if the pre-recorded content is your blind spot, I'm happy because I'm hiding in your blind spot right now.
It's a good thing. People
want
that.
I'm a cyclist sneaking up on you.
Yeah,
on the blind spot.
Yeah.
And I only want that because I want everything to be scalable.
Yeah.
Because I can't be far more scalable, out there preaching that, you know what, let's pay teachers what they're worth.
Yeah, sure.
And let's invent a model that rewards them for their intellectual property, their experience, that kind of stuff. So we'll see. And we have very different models there. And we're just barely starting to scratch the surface about this kind of thing.
My name is Michael Jones, and you're listening to The Future.
The Future is hosted by me, Chris Doe. The show is edited by Stuart Schuster. Big thanks to Adam Sanborn, who composed our theme song. To subscribe to The Future podcast, check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Make sure you rate and review our episodes. Don't miss out on upcoming events, live streams, workshops, and announcements by going to thefuture.com and sign up for the newsletter link at the bottom. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, @TheFutureIsHere. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening.